Deborah Hill, producer of Escape from New York, and I'm here with production designer Joe Alves. And together we're going to take you through some of the problems and how we did the special effects and some of the new ideas that we generated back then in, when was it, 1980. So here's Joe Alves, and I think he's going to really do a swell job in telling everybody out there about how we did this kind of fun breaking stuff.
In 1988, the crime rate in the United States rises 400%.
Well, in this computer map, what we tried to do is to show people that Manhattan was an island, because I remember when we first screened the picture, we didn't have this opening on there. And in our preview audiences, we realized that a lot of kids didn't know that Manhattan was an island. It can be completely closed off. So we decided to tag this opening on, you know, after the fact.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
The United States police force, like an army, is encamped around the island. There are no guards inside the prison, only prisoners and the worlds they have made.
And of course, this is the point of view of Manhattan from the Statue of Liberty. And now we begin our live action shots. Joe, you want to talk about them?
Yeah, well, this was interesting because the Statue of Liberty really depicts where we are in New York. Though we built the main set actually in the Sepulveda Dam area in San Fernando Valley. So to accomplish this look, we actually used an old Hitchcock trick about moving the camera and passing through an area of black or a solid color so you can make a cut without it not looking like a cut if the camera move was consistent.
And there's the black right there.
Yeah. Well, no, this would be at the Sentry booth.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's when we tied the Statue of Liberty when we shot. We should just tell those people who are watching this that most of this picture was shot in St. Louis because there had been a recent fire downtown and the city was rendered, you know, just ashes. So we shot most of it there with the exception of one shot. And here's our miniature.
Right. That's a miniature. That's a total miniature.
And miniature helicopter.
Right. Now, that was all done at Roger Corman, correct?
At New World, yes. Yeah, and Jim Cameron is the special effects cameraman who was shooting these effects.
Right.
And this particular shot here was shot in Long Beach, the main action, and that is a live helicopter.
With real water.
With real water. That's one of the hardest things to do is water. In terms of miniatures and things like that, because of scale.
Right. I've had a few water pictures.
Oh,
in my
yeah,
life.
Jaws, I think, right?
Yeah, about three of them.
So this is all live action right here, shot in Long Beach, tied in with the miniature of Manhattan and the wall of Sepulveda Dam.
Right. This is a
miniature
shot.
With miniature helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the setup of our bridge,
right?
Which is what takes the finale and the end of the movie. And then this is the helicopter in New York at the real Statue of Liberty, the only shot that we did there.
Right, and this is the shot I'm talking about. So what we did is we built this sentry stand or booth, guard station, whatever you want to call it. And we were so tight on money on this picture that we prefab the set, put it on a truck from L.A. to New York. We got on the last boat to Liberty Island, Statue of Liberty area. The crew set it up. We waited till dark. Now, this is a shot I'm talking about. Liberty and Securely Control. And as you pass through this, Hitchcock has done this a couple times. It works really well. Okay, now you can cut. Now you start your film again with the same movement, and now we're in L.A. And we built this set in the Sepulveda Dam area near the 405 and the 101 freeway. I think it worked pretty well, actually.
I think it works great.
Yeah.
And there was no way for us back then, with the kind of dollars that we had, to build the Statue of Liberty.
No.
So.
No, or, you know, and it works so well because we used the real Statue of Liberty. We had that huge scale. And as you say, this was a movie that was, say, a small budget, having been involved with some big budget pictures in the past. When I got involved with this, I tried to think of it as a big movie, only find ways to do it with the economy in mind.
Well, I mean, the whole entire budget of the picture was about $6.5 million. And so the effects portion of the movie was $360,000.
And I think I spent less than $500,000 on sets. This we shot at the Art Center in Pasadena. Yeah, it was great. It had a really nice, clean, sort of sterile look to it.
And of course, you designed not only the sets, but you also were involved in the design of the look of the costumes, as well as all the patches, all the signs, and all that. And I think that it made for a very distinctive look of the picture. I mean, it definitely had a style to it that you brought a lot to.
It was a fun project. It has a really cult following. I was in France a few years ago, and some French critics, they just love this movie because of the stylization.
Now, look at that limo. Doesn't it look like totally outdated?
Yeah, this is a problem with, you know, vehicles just sort of push you right back to where you are, unfortunately.
We got a small jet in trouble over restricted airspace. Where is it? 7 miles out, closing.
This was primarily what we're seeing is the top of an understructure where this is the understructure of this United States Police Force headquarters.
And this is actually a set that was built. And also, too, I must tell everyone that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers were very, very supportive in helping us with all the helicopters and things like that, with and consulting. And in St. Louis, a lot of the U.S. Army that you see is actually Missouri National Guard.
Yeah, when we get to the three Hueys landing in that parking lot, it's pretty amazing.
Remember that?
Yeah. I mean, it was, well, we'll get to that sequence because...
And all of the graphics for everything that's on screen had to be sort of pre-designed so that when we actually shot in these rooms, you could see everything happening. So, like this particular graphic. So everything was done on camera as opposed to burning it in later.
One of the let's see what happens here. This is a miniature.
Miniature. This would be the Air Force One, the president's plane.
Tell this to the workers when they ask where your leader went.
That's Nancy Stevens, who is in Halloween and Halloween 2, and she was just in H2O with Jamie Lee Curtis last year. She's been in a lot of our films.
Have struck a fatal blow to the racist police state. What better revolutionary example than to let the president perish in the inhuman dungeon of his own imperialist prison? The bosses of the racist...
Unlock the pod. She's bolted the door.
Can't you shoot off the lock?
No, sir, she's...
Casting Donald Pleasance was real interesting because people kept saying, why are we casting an Englishman as the United States president? But we love Donald. Obviously, Donald was in Halloween, and John wanted to use him. We think he's an amazing actor, and I think he plays just the best buffoon of a president ever.
Absolutely. I love this. Let's get him to the pod. You know, this was a the silliest thing. Yeah, the pod was this real safety device that no matter what happened, what disaster had happened in the world, the pod would survive. And we used an egg as a symbol of strength. I have no idea why. It just sort of looked good.
And that shot was a composite of live action at Sepulveda Dam and a miniature. This is a total miniature going in.
Great.
This, again, graphics design for the movie. This is a miniature again.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about this airplane crash when we get to it. The interesting thing about the effects, you know, I had been involved with Doug Trumbull and John Dykstra and, you know, a good amount of very, very top effects people. And I was telling Deborah when I came on this picture, you know, they're all great, but they all want to sell you their new machine. And so what we did is we did some sketches, and we went around and we shopped, just like we were going to Vons or Ralph's or whatever.
Well, John Dykstra, and, if I recall, wanted $1 million as his fee.
Yeah. So it was a question of, you know, not what can you do for us. Here's what we want. Now, you know, what is it going to cost to do it? And that's where we ended up.
Well, that's how you and I worked so closely together, because we had to be, and John Carpenter, of course, because we had to be so scene specific.
Right.
These are all miniature helicopters running, going over to the island.
See, like today, everybody wants to digitally sell you their new program. It was their motion control system or various things that were happening 20 years ago. It's pretty much new technology.
Okay, and this is the scene you were talking about with the Hueys. These are National Guard, Missouri National Guard Hueys landing in a parking lot in St. Louis. And the funny thing about it is that they had these incredible black gear over their faces, this face gear, and it was so dark that they could barely see it. And as they would run off the helicopters, they would trip and fall. And so, as you see, there's only about 10 of them, but I think we started with 100.
This was a section of St. Louis, actually, which was designated as urban renewal, and I think they were going to demolish most of it. And we brought in, my decorator was Claudia, and Claudia would do this amazing, we'd bring in like three or four 40-foot, you know, truckloads of stuff, of junk. And they would just strewn it all over.
But every day. I mean,
every day.
So we should talk about this, is that we shot the movie from 6 p.m., 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning.
Right.
And we had to clear the streets up at night.
Yeah.
I mean, actually not at night. We had to clear the streets up in the morning. So the morning traffic could come through.
Right.
So bulldozers would come in at wrap and push everything to the side.
It was amazing.
And then around 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd get your decorators out there ready at like 5 to begin to put everything back into the streets in a very creative two-camera way.
And I have to say, Dean Cundey did an amazing job of lighting like 7 blocks in a matter of hours. I couldn't believe it, having worked on other pictures where it took so long to light. But This junk, it was just pretty amazing. Claudia's crew, you know, laying it down, picking
it up.
What
I must say is this character here is from Assault on Precinct 13.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy in the ice cream truck, which killed the little girl.
Yeah, he was really an interesting character.
Of course, that was, you know, fake finger.
The finger of the prez.
With, of course, the president's ring on it. So we could, you know, undeniably say it was the president's finger.
It was pretty amazing. When those Hueys came down in that parking lot with all the junk flying, I don't think we quite anticipated that much turbulence. Now, we're going to see, is this where the airplane comes in?
No, not yet. This is where they run back. I mean, obviously what we did is we had a shot, we had three camera shot of the Hueys coming down, people running past the cameras, and now this is them running back onto the Hueys and the Hueys going up. And now we're back on the set.
You know, we ended up in St. Louis because we were looking for a bridge. We had a choice. either build a section of a bridge near a huge wall, or find a bridge that wasn't used and then build the wall. And we found this sort of non-used bridge in St. Louis. And so when we got there and we realized, my gosh, this looks an awful lot like lower New York.
Well, actually, the story is that we sent Barry Benardi.
Right.
We sent Barry Benardi, who was our location manager at the time. He's now a producer. He started with us on the Halloween. In fact, he was the body by the train tracks in Halloween. Barry Benardi, we sent him an all-expense-paid vacation across America looking for the worst city in the country, and he came up with St. Louis. And then, of course, we had the great bridge there.
Right, the bridge
And
work.
We bought the bridge for $1 from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Right. When we get to the bridge, I'll talk about the wall. But it gave us a lot of other things, too, like the train station, which wasn't being
Madison
used.
Square Garden.
Yeah. No. And the train station we used.
Oh, yes. That was where the Duke of New York hung out.
Yeah, exactly.
The train station.
The Duke of New York.
Men to be decorated by the president.
And, of course, this is just a set that we built on a soundstage. And
did we ever have a soundstage?
Well, I don't think it was a soundstage.
No.
Where'd we shoot this stuff?
We couldn't afford a soundstage.
So where'd we build this?
This is what I can't remember, because when we got to the... that's an interesting point. No soundstage rings in my mind.
But we built the set.
I know. We built a number of sets. I just wondered if we built them in one of the schools we shot. Why can't I remember this? Anyway, because when we built the exterior, we went out to the desert because we couldn't afford to do it on the...
That's right.
Yeah.
When we built the exterior of the roof of the World Trade Center, mm-hmm. we actually... Well, we'll talk about that when we get there to it, but we actually put that on the desert floor.
Yeah. And... Lexington and 43rd Street.
You go in, find the president, bring him out in 24 hours, and you're a free man.
24 hours, huh?
I'm making you an offer.
Bullshit.
Straight, just like I said.
I'll think about it.
You know, when we shot Escape from L.A. on the first night of shooting Escape from L.A., Kurt wore that exact outfit.
Did he have it?
He kept it.
Really?
Kurt Russell, Snake Plissken is Kurt Russell's favorite character.
Yeah.
So he kept this costume.
Amazing.
So on the first night, he came out of his trailer looking just like this 17 years later.
Right.
And it was like we were in a time machine. We looked at each other and just cracked up.
You know how to get in quiet.
Amazing. He had the beard too?
He had the beard. We had to use hair extensions to make his hair. His hair in Escape from L.A. is a little bit longer than it was in here. But he, you know, obviously he had the eye patch. He had the beard.
Right. And
but for this, but you know, he still had this outfit on.
Right.
Some of them have cars. They took old junkers that were left behind, converted them to steam.
I'm curious now. I'm going to have to call Ward and find out where we built this.
And power. Yeah, greenhouses, rigged up generators.
Back there, see the U.S. Police force. That was a design that you came up with, and that eagle, that a distinct eagle.
Yeah.
And we ended up using that design in a lot of the marketing materials that we created for the film, both in domestically and internationally. And of course, that eagle was, you know, dominated a lot of various props and things, and we were able to stick that eagle up whenever we needed to identify where we were. You know, it was used on the helicopters. It was used on, you know, a lot of the vehicles, the tanks and things like that. So it's interesting that you can take one design and use it in so many different ways. And it's one of the cost-cutting things, I think, that you did to achieve the look.
Slap an eagle on it. Yeah, I did them all in silver on something because I have one at home somewhere.
Yeah, I have one in silver.
Yeah. I don't know what that was for. We'll probably see it.
Now, this, again, was still the Art College of Pasadena.
Right. My feeling is that we probably took an area and put the president's or the...
No, I think we did that someplace else. I'm not quite sure.
I know. It's amazing. I can remember something so well in detail, and then other things, it just escapes you.
It's
22 hours, 59 minutes, 57 seconds.
We talked about 24.
One of the interesting things, too, about this clock that was designed for Kurt Russell's wrist, for Snake Plissken's wrist, is we actually used this as a time clock to keep track of where Snake was at any given moment. And it's very interesting, when we actually went and cut the picture in post-production, we found that we, at times, lost track, and therefore we didn't have this ticking clock that we needed to keep the suspense going. And we ended up shooting of times, very specific times.
Of inserts,
so that we could use that. So that clock was really, really important. And of course, the design of it was very, very important to the
movie. We had the clock on the T-shirts, didn't we?
There's John Strobel.
Right.
I have no idea
what John is.
John Strobel is another actor that we used a lot. He was in The Fog.
Mm-hmm.
In the opening sequence of The Fog main titles, where in a grocery store where all the bottles begin to shake.
That idea you had about turning the Gulf Fire around 180 degrees and flying off to Canada.
What did you do to me, asshole?
My idea, Plissken. Something we've been fooling around with. Two microscopic capsules lodged in your arteries. They're already starting to dissolve. In 22 hours...
Boy, Lee Van Cleef was wonderful in this movie. I mean, he was somebody that John always admired and always wanted to work with. And I think that when we cast him and we got him, and it really gave some sort of legitimacy to this whole process. I mean, he's just such a great villain.
Yeah, yeah.
They're protected by the cores. 15 minutes before the last hour's up, we can neutralize the charge with X-rays.
There it goes.
We'll burn out the charges if you have the president.
I think that's one of the inserts that I was talking about.
Inserts are fantastic, you know. But this was great because we had the ticking clock all the time.
When I get back, I'm going to kill you.
Kurt was great in this.
The Gulf Fire's waiting.
Now, this runway that we're driving out to now is that we built is actually in the... out by
Indian Dunes.
Indian Dunes, right. Yes, exactly. And we actually had to buy, this is a two-man
glider,
which we ended up having to buy. And after the movie was over, it took me about 2 years to sell this thing.
Really?
Yeah, I used to have it out in the Mojave Desert, and I leased it to a school to teach gliding. But so interesting, because it's taken up by another plane and then it's dropped.
Right, right.
They drop the line. This is an interior that we shot, and we shot this on a soundstage or on a warehouse somewhere.
Yeah.
Where did we shoot this?
Suppose he's dead, Hauk.
It'll come to me.
Maybe we should have a contest.
Yeah, right. Where did we do all this stuff? Of course, some of this stuff could be done on an insert stage, but
yeah, it was. I think the lighting in here was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is basically him inside this a mock-up of the interior.
Right.
There's the plane taking off.
Mm-hmm.
There's that taking off.
And there's a line in the movie: you land at the only place you can land, top of the trade, you know,
World Trade Center.
Yeah, like okay. Now, that was, so we went there. We went to the top of the Trade Center and looked down on New York and said, how in the heck are we going to make this movie?
Well, I remember scouting. One of the things that we did is we hired a helicopter once to fly over rooftops in the San Fernando Valley looking for a rooftop to land on.
Yeah, exactly.
And we realized that it was dangerous.
Yeah.
It was at night. We couldn't have any, because New York is basically, the lights are out, we couldn't have any landing lights set up.
Yeah, that was the thing. Yeah, we were looking for some kind of warehouse, something that we could use as a landing.
And then we decided to build it in the desert, and we actually built it on the ground. And you actually built a rooftop on the ground, and the way we shot it, we were able to land this thing, and he was able to get off. And now, this is all miniature, and that's a miniature
glider
going through here. And as you see, there are no lights on in New York. So it was interesting. I mean, it was a lot of problems. Where's your light source coming from? All those kinds of things that you have when you have the lights out.
I love the way this stuff was made to look like computer-generated stuff today.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting?
These graphics.
Yeah, the graphics look like they were done on the computer. course, they were done in different methods.
And what's interesting, too, is that they're 3D graphics.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, a 10-year-old kid can do now.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
But back then, it was state-of-the-art.
Yeah. The set was probably just as high as the height of a scaffold.
Here, yes, here is...
So about three and a half feet.
Miniature. Of course, graphic. We'll show you where the real set comes in. Right there.
Yeah. That's the set, and...
And here's the graphic. That's the set. There we are on the desert floor.
Yeah, it was just a big expanse of...
Well, I think it wasn't as big as it looks here.
It's just it was a fairly large set. I think we just took scaffolding and covered it with plywood.
And that's a miniature there.
Pliskin.
And this was all built and designed by Joe. This would be like the elevator shaft. And essentially, he couldn't walk. He couldn't take an elevator down. And so what we ended up doing was shooting a stairwell, and we shot the stairwell at the college out, the Disney College. What's the name of that?
Cal Arts. Yeah, it was a fairly large set because we had to pull that thing in there. I mean, it was not an expensive set because it was...
asphalt.
Yeah, we plywood, and then we used, to paint it like asphalt. And extremely simple construction. You know, the movie had this sort of, stylistic look, and being that, you can get away with a lot, you know. Now, we're at...
Cal Arts.
Cal Arts out in Valencia. Now, I mean, they wouldn't let us graffiti the walls, so I bought... You know,
rolls
hundreds of yards of butcher paper, and we had to cover the walls of butcher paper. You know, I'm finally getting through one of the extra rolls of butcher paper after 20 years. My kids are using it. But we covered these walls with butcher paper, and then we graffitied.
And then here we are in St. Louis.
Now we're in St. Louis, and I want to talk about, are we going to go?
The plane. You're going to get to see the plane here.
Let me tell you about this plane you're going to see. I was in Tucson, and that's where you buy plane parts, wrecked plane parts or airplanes or whatever.
All airplanes go to die there.
And so I went there with my assistant art director, Chris Horner, and we spent a day marking all the pieces, the large pieces we wanted. And as we got to sort of check out what we were going to buy, the guy said, "You know, someone is selling this DC-8. It's an old
which is right there. Yeah. There's the DC-8.
Right, a DC-8, which is not a jet. It's a propelled thing with four." And I said, "Really?" And he says, "Yeah, it's in St. Louis, and doesn't have any engines. And he's selling it for $8,000." I said, "Could you put a hold on all the stuff that we ordered?" And we went to St. Louis. Now, my construction coordinator at the time and paint foreman was. Ward Welton. We bought this. Ward cut this in pieces, and we trucked it in at night without any permits, city permits or anything, and placed it in this area. Now, it was so funny because people, I don't know, drunks or whatever, said, "Oh, yeah, I saw that plane crash."
Well, the next day in the St. Louis newspaper was a shot of this crashed plane with eyewitness accounts of it crashing from people that they had spoken to. Complete lie. Now, you did an amazing job here, and those fires are just...
Well, I still talk to Roy Abergas, who's a special effects guy, and, you know, we would start the fire... And then I would yell after the cut, turn it, get rid, pull it out, put it out. And Roy, I would get really panicky because they weren't putting it out fast enough. And I think this went on about three times. And, the last time it's burning aluminum and titanium and magnesium and all these incredible things, and you can't put it out. And I'm going crazy, and he's just laughing. Everybody's just breaking up because they think it's the funniest thing in the world. Well, John was very cool. He had gotten his shots, but, I obviously panicked because I thought I'd lost my set. It was really one of the neatest things that we've ever done, I think, in a movie for the cost.
That's right. I think it was a brilliant, I mean, I as a producer stood on the sideline and said, another walk-by? Because this was essentially Kurt Russell, Snake Plissken, walking through the streets of New York. And the amount of art direction that required for him to do a walk-by was amazing.
But, you know, I know it's a walk-by, there's no dialogue, but it really, really established a very rich look.
Scope for them. Now, here we are, exterior theater in St. Louis. I can remember shooting this because we had to, this was a location move.
Very old, Yeah, it was a difficult location move.
It was a difficult location move. And now we're on the interior of the Wiltern Theater, which is on Wilshire Boulevard in L.A. Which is completely redone now, but 20 years ago was a total wreck.
It's a real hot place now. It was down like Wilshire in Vermont or something. They had a lot of architectural interest.
Yeah, this was a really good scene. Now, this was this was a send-off on Stephen Sondheim's song. And which we ended up not getting the rights to, and we had to go back and re-record it. I had approached Sondheim. Yes, I had approached Stephen Sondheim of Everything's Coming Up Roses, right?
Uh-huh.
You know. And then years later in The Fisher King, I ended up getting the Stephen Sondheim song.
You did?
Yeah, for Michael Jeter. So. And here we are back in, this is still the Wiltern. This is in the back of the Wiltern.
Yeah, right. Going down.
Going down this basement,
Hey,
you Snake Plissken. Boy, I loved Ernest Borgnine as Cabbie.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, he's perfect.
I think that, you know, the casting in this movie and just the way John wrote it with these sort of archetypes of the kinds of people you would find in New York, if it was a prison, you know, with the Duke of New York and the cabbie and Brain and Maggie.
Oh, we haven't come to.
Well, that's another thing we can talk about, too, when we get to Brain, because he lived at USC.
Right.
In the library.
I know, with a oil with Derek in there.
Yeah. So this was all down in the Wiltern in the basement. We actually shot basement for basement here.
All right. With more junk. Big on junk.
And this is where he, Snake Plissken meets Season, right? Is that Season?
No.
A regular punk.
Yeah, Season is in the
Chock Full of Nuts.
We'll talk about Chock Full of Nuts. It's really
That was a great scene.
Right.
I loved that, Chock Full of Nuts. Now, that we shot out in the desert, too.
Yeah, we'll talk about that because we couldn't afford a sage, as I recall. And we really could have used one with a pit.
Nice boots.
But
you built a hole in the ground or something.
Yeah, right. Dug a hole.
Easy now, Chief. I'm walking.
Oh, yes, this is where he finds.
Oh, the.
The president's beeper, except it's not
the
president.
Right.
That's right. This is where he finds the president's beeper, but it's not the president.
Yeah, guy took it off.
In fact, it's Buck Flowers. Buck Flowers is in the fog.
Oh, you just.
Buck Flowers is the actor. He's a
repertory theater here. Yeah. We just keep using the same people.
That's right. And interesting enough, I actually did a movie with Buck Flowers before I was a producer. I think when I was a script supervisor, he's in one of the pictures.
Oh, Jesus. It may be just an impact on the mechanism itself.
Hauk.
I'm right here, Plissken.
You assholes are looking at it, but it's
That's
not
Chuck Cyphers. He plays the sheriff in Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
In Halloween 2, and he also was in Assault on Precinct 13.
All right, get your machine ready. I'm coming out.
And there's Tommy Atkins.
Saves time on casting.
The president is dead. You got that? Somebody's had him for dinner.
Plissken, if you get back in that glider, I'll shoot you down. You climb out, I'll burn you off the wall. Do you understand that, Plissken?
Isn't it funny that it's got an antenna?
Yeah, I know. It's we're back to more junk.
And what's so interesting, too, is just the lighting. Isn't it just beautiful?
You know, Dean just did such an incredible job.
Yeah.
Look at that shot. It's incredible.
It's a beautiful, beautiful shot.
And he did it quickly.
Yeah. Well, we laid a lot of cable. I mean, what we did is we had people working. We had pre-light every single day. In fact, when we made Escape from New York, there was crew working 24 hours a day.
Right, the lighting crew.
You had the light. Oh, there's the pod.
Yeah, there's pod.
There's our egg.
But he used what, HMIs?
He used HMI lights.
And because I'd come off of Close Encounters and we had like 48 electricians up above using big arcs. And I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be another big arc thing, you know, and where you need an electrician on each arc. So the HMIs really did the trick.
Yeah, HMIs were really, really great. We ended up purchasing the HMIs on this movie and selling them back to the lighting team.
I ran into the lighting guy. We went to a party, and he came up and he said, you know, I worked on that lighting crew, and you probably don't remember me, blah, 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 and Escape from New York. The guy's very successful now. I've been in Australia doing a big picture.
You know, I had forgotten how little dialogue is actually in this movie.
Well, it's a lot of just visual walkthroughs and setting moods.
And it's accomplished through really art, you know, production design and lighting. I mean, because there's very little else. And, you know, using these already burned out streets of
St. Louis.
It's funny that there's this manhole in here because, you know, we used a manhole in Assault on Precinct 13. You know, John just keeps using the same stuff over and over. Same actors, you know. He's really good at recycling.
If this is, let's see.
This is what gets him into Chock Full of Nuts,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And Chock Full of Nuts, once again, is that great icon that we all in our generation recognize as being part of New York.
This was built at Indian Dunes.
On
the desert floor. And this whole set was designed to the action. The camera moved. We built it as we planned. Now, let me tell you, I've worked for two directors that I really felt confident that you could build half sets for and they wouldn't double-cross you. In other words, turn around where you didn't have a set. I had John pan slightly to the left when Kurt entered the Chock Full of Nuts, you would have seen
a cactus.
Right.
I remember.
The other director was Alfred Hitchcock. I worked with him years ago when I was a very young assistant art director, and we built half sets for him. John was so well prepared in his mind when he shot a movie as to what he needed and what he didn't need.
Well, I should point out to the folks out here that Cecin Hubley, who Kurt Russell was married to in real life at this time,
mm-hmm.
and prior to making Escape from New York, John Carpenter had directed Kurt and Cecin in Elvis, which was a big ABC TV film. Mm-hmm. Kurt played Elvis Presley, and Cecin played Priscilla Presley. And they fell in love and got married, and we cast Cecin in this role. Because we were all on location anyway.
Right.
So
exactly.
Why not?
really, you got the hotel room already paid for, so.
That's the economy of making these movies.
Right.
An asshole.
But this is an amazing thing. I mean, the fact that we actually thought we can't afford a soundstage. Yeah. What we need is to put the money into the set design, signage, you know, all that kind of stuff, the bigger than life look. And the fact that we thought, let's build it outside on the desert.
Right. I think it also worked out because we had two sets out there. I don't know if we had a full night shoot in a full on one set or the other.
Right. You know, on the rooftop or on the checkful nights.
Yeah. And that's part of designing, too, is there's the convenience for the crew and the time that you save for moving from one location to the other, or one set to the other.
Well, because also, too, you could be pre-lighting or rehearsing
exactly.
on one set or dressing another set while the main shooting crew is working on the other.
Right. You know, I mean, travel time's expensive. And so we try to consider these things. See, the windows are all fogged up because if you could see through them, you'd see the desert.
You'd see cactus.
Yeah. And as this camera... As the camera moved, the set was built. You didn't have much set other than what you see on the camera. Now we're coming outside, and this is still the set. And then it...
yes,
yeah,
I remember.
This is all the set.
This is all the set.
Right.
So it's like a two-story set with a...
right.
God, that looks so great. It's kind of a fire escape, I guess,
right.
that New York's kind of famous for.
Right.
Anyway, right?
But we built no extra rooms, as I recall. Almost nothing that we didn't... we shot everything. The economy was incredible.
Well, essentially what he does is he, you know, goes up a fire escape, goes into one room,
right.
cuts a hole into another room, comes back out, and we're probably just on the other side, right?
Yeah, on the other side of the wall is St. Louis.
That's
we,
right.
We
he
jump
jumps
over the wall.
Over the wall.
And then, well, let's see, we jump over the wall, and I think we're in St. Louis
yes,
now.
Yes, we are in St. Louis.
Because I matched that wall.
Right, to a practical wall.
Right.
But we did shoot St. Louis locations first.
Yeah.
And then we came back to L.A., and we shot L.A., so you were able to match certain things because
right.
we had picked up the shots. But, I mean, that's amazing, too, that John Carpenter is the kind of director that really shoots with an eye to the budget
yeah.
and also to the production design. And we are with Cabbie again.
I just think it's such a waste how we make films somehow, you know, with directors that don't plan. And you build so much stuff that you never shoot.
Well, this is that famous American Bandstand
right. yeah, yeah.
That just I just love.
Second Street at night. I've been driving a cab here for 30 years, and I'm telling you, you don't walk around here at night. Yes, sir. It'll kill you, strip you in 10 seconds flat.
And, of course, the American Bandstand tape is really kind of the whole concept of this.
Mm-hmm.
The end of the movie
right.
is the switch of these tapes. So it's kind of the MacGuffin, I guess, is what you might call it, huh?
Oh,
that he was wonderful.
Fliskin in my cab? Wait till I tell Eddie. Hey, hang on, Snake.
Oh, we're under the... we're in St. Louis.
We're in St. Louis.
Yeah, under the bridge there. Not that bridge, another bridge, I think.
Hey, what were you doing back there, Snake?
Looking for somebody.
Well, why didn't you ask me? Hell, I know everybody in this town. Yes, sir, I've been driving this cab for 30 years. This very same
That's the other
cab.
Thing, too, about these cabs, these yellow cabs. For many people that of our generation, we know these big, fabulous yellow cabs
right.
that are in Manhattan, and
yeah.
they really don't have them anymore.
Yeah.
These are the checker cabs.
Yeah, the checker cabs
and,
were...
And
yeah.
we really specifically needed to have the checker cabs, and we had a number of these cabs because they had to do kinds of things. I remember one cab in the final chase has to split in half.
Yeah.
And so these cabs were rigged to do different things. The cabs were rigged. There was the driving cab for this one. There was a cab that gets shot up.
Yeah, half a cab, I remember.
Half a
yeah,
cab,
right.
exactly. Then we have the cab that splits in two. Oh, I remember the scene. This is in the warehouse district.
Yeah.
This would be...
you know, if you go to the lower part of New York, and it's... New York has such different looks, but... this is below or near the village.
You
sort of in the meat packing area?
Yeah. Yeah, the meat packing area.
Well, this was the meat packing area of St. Louis.
I remember the very first thoughts because of the economy. John talked about
it. And, oh, by the way, we are in St. Louis, and
right.
this is supposed to be the Library of New York.
Right.
And when we go inside this particular edifice, we will end up being in a library at the USC campus.
Right, exactly.
And that will be where Brain and Maggie live.
We had entertained the thought of shooting this on a New York street in the back lot of a studio for about 2 minutes because I grew up on Universal back lots and literally doing a lot of television, and I really found that not tremendously interesting, and I discouraged John for even thinking that way and said, you know, I think we could do better. And obviously it opened the scope because we didn't have to limit ourselves.
Well, it was so interesting that when we went to St. Louis, we found these great
things. It just opened it up.
That worked for
right.
I mean, this wasn't exactly a replica of the library,
right.
but shot under our circumstances would give the impression that it was. And the other great wonderful thing is the train station there, which serves for Madison Square Garden
exactly.
interior.
I want to meet.
And now what's interesting is this is Adrienne Barbeau,
right.
who and married John Carpenter. John directed her in a movie with Lauren Hutton for television called High Rise. That's where they met. And then he rewrote The Fog for her. She played Stevie Wayne. And, in fact, I wrote her part, which I think was the greatest part she's ever played, while they were on their honeymoon. And then, of course, she was in Escape from New York.
No.
Who's that?
Where did we shoot this?
I think that this is part of the Madison Square Garden set. This is the interior library, because when we pan
that's
over...
That's right. You know, this is...
This is the interior library at USC.
Yes, because it has that tile.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now I remember.
And now here it is, and you're going to see this great oil derrick in the middle of the...
See, that made a lot of sense.
Well, that's why he's the brain.
Right.
Because
right.
he knows how to get oil.
Right.
And of course, here's Harry Dean Stanton, tremendous actor.
Yeah.
How you been, Harold? It's been a long time.
You never told me you knew Snake Plissken, Brain.
Isn't that great? Hey, Brain, I can use some gas if you can spare some.
I'm glad you remember me. Man should remember his past. Kansas City, 4 years ago, you ran out on me. You left me sitting there.
I love this scene.
Yeah, he is so great.
So, you know, what's interesting is 20 years later, you know, people see this movie and they think that they talk about Leningrad and they talk about Kansas City and they talk about Fresno, kind of gives Snake Plissken this past.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is some of the fans of the movie actually have created, like, lives for Snake Plissken, like what happened really in Leningrad and what happened in Kansas City. And it's really just part of Snake Plissken lore.
Yeah, this is a real cult following.
Listen, I'll take you out of here. Yeah. Jet glider just a couple of blocks down the street. Now all you gotta do is get me to him.
No kidding? On the level? Hey, will you take me too?
We got a deal somewhere else.
No glider.
We've got the president. And the Duke's taking everybody out of here.
Never happened, baby. You see, I know something you and the Duke don't know. Only got so long before Mr. President doesn't mean a whole lot.
Yeah, it's amazing that the campus at USC would allow us to do what we did here.
How did we get that location anyway?
Barry Bernardi.
Yeah.
Found St. Louis, found this.
Right.
I mean, because look at the great production values that we get without having to build it.
Yeah.
A fabulous room, fireplaces, fires, candles, those books. I mean, everything was dressed to camera, but the architecture of the room gave it a sense of scope. So now here we are in St. Louis again, And I love this shot of them, the four of them, walking down the steps. They're kind of like, you know, the defiant ones in many ways. You know, I just love it. And I think that they're on their way to go meet the Duke.
The Duke. I got to tell you about the Duke and the Duke's car. Deborah said to me, you know those little crystal balls that they put in cars? Maybe we could do something like that so we get some sort of funny light thing. And it gave me a crazy idea about crystal chandeliers. And, you know, this is so off the wall. So I had my decorator look for crystal chandeliers with bases, actually. We turned them upside down, I think that's how it worked. And I said, you better get six of them because we're going to do some stunts with a car with crystal chandeliers on the fenders. And I remember your expression when you saw it was, that's not what I meant, but...
I loved this car.
Yeah, I thought it was.
I loved this car. And what was really interesting is that when we released the movie, we all went out on different publicity tours. Adrienne did some, and Kurt Russell did some, and John did some. And they sent me with Isaac Hayes to Detroit and Chicago and Pittsburgh and Washington and New York. And they sent us with the car. And when we would, after we would do the press releases, you know, the press junkets during the day, we'd be, you know, on different TV and radio stations, we would go down the streets in the car and we would pull into drive-in movies. So there's Isaac Hayes, the Duke, and me in the back seat of this car going from, you know, drive-in to drive-in to drive-in and him signing autographs and stuff like that. So, do you remember Mario, the Teamster?
Yes, right.
Mario took his car all across America.
Are you kidding?
And he brought his kids with him so they got to see America.
Oh, I see. I forgot now. We made a special rig so we could hang the chandelier. That's right. It didn't have a base. And, I think she bought these at Sears because we needed to get a bunch of them because later in the movie you'll see that it has to jump a ramp and do all this stuff. And, of course, how many takes, you know.
Isaac Hayes is such a wonderful Duke here.
Oh, yeah. He's perfect.
When we were writing Escape from L.A. and he heard that we were going to be doing Escape from L.A., he used to call me on the phone all the time and say, you know, hey, I want to be in that movie. Can I come back? And I'd say, but the Duke is dead.
The Duke is dead. That's right. The Duke died.
He's a great guy. He really is. And it was just so much fun touring with him, and we did the premiere of the movie actually in New York, and we were all there for it.
Is that where he lives?
No, actually, he lived in Atlanta. Now he lives in New Jersey. See, all these cars were sort of custom made in some way. I think the idea of these cars are almost like, you know, what you get like in Cuba, you know, when basically we isolated Cuba, the cars that were left were these cool 50s models.
Right.
And it's the same thing here with Manhattan. Once it became an island, we left what was there on the island. And that's the assumption, I think, that we make, which is why we have these cars. But it's interesting enough, the cars, to me, are the only thing that really dates the movie.
But in essence, when you're on the island, they're not dated because it's, you know, it's...
But looking back, I think the graphics are amazing. Yeah. Look at that, just another drive-by. I think the graphics are amazing. I think the production designing is just, it sets a tone, a look that's unique for the time. I mean, I think this is pre-Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, you know, many, many future filmmakers tried to emulate this.
You know, this interesting... I was in New York at the time this came out, and Vincent Cabby, who was a critic for the New York Times, wrote three articles about movies with looks and stuff, and he had Blade Runner.
That's right.
And Escape from New York, and he was comparing them, how they were really so different and innovative and stuff. Of course, they made Blade Runner for like four times or five times more than what we made Escape from New York.
And interesting enough, the production designer of Blade Runner did Escape from L.A.
Right, I know. Larry Paul.
Larry Paul. Yeah. Yes. I mean, just look at how rich and everything it is. It's just, it's really unique. And the fact that, again, that we'd have to, like, put this stuff out during the day.
Yeah.
We had to build, right. Put it out for night, yes. Clean it up during the day, you know.
We had great use of forklifts. I was on the bridge sequence. I'll talk about it later. But Larry Franco is the first AD. We would argue on who'd get the forklift, you know, for the next shot, or I needed it while we were preparing for the shot that came after that one. And we would be dead without forklifts on this movie.
Well, here's the exterior train station, which is the encampment of the Duke of New York. And we actually have some scenes in the train.
Right.
Third car from the inn by the last campfire.
And there goes the Duke, and his entourage.
Right, his entourage. The train station was not used for anything. It was built in the 1880s, I believe.
You should say now.
Yeah, then they redid
it. They've redone it, and it's like it's, you know.
Incredible.
A shopping center.
Well, it had this unbelievable.
But it was done as a replica. It was built as a replica, though smaller,
mm-hmm.
of the Grand Central Station in New York.
Right. It was the metal structure, Tinker Toys kind of thing, where you had all these metal and glass skylight effects. Yeah, this is the cars that were there, not being used, just waiting for us to shoot a movie.
It's interesting how accommodating St. Louis ended up to be, not only from a production design point of view, but also from a city that really wanted us to be there.
Yeah.
They basically handed us the keys to the city.
Yeah. He's on his way here now. He didn't say nothing else about it. You know, it's amazing just the difference 20 years makes as far as cooperation that you get. I mean, people, we've shot so many movies on location now and television and stuff, and people get a little jaded to it. They sort of welcomed us back then.
Yeah, they welcomed
now
us.
It's a little.
They welcomed us. They accommodated us. They accommodated certainly our budget.
Right.
And, I mean, there was a presence on the streets of a crew working 24 hours a day for the entire 7 or 8 weeks that we were there. And, of course, here it's Donald Pleasence again as our president.
Right.
And this is the shootout to get him. That's kind of like from Scanners.
Yeah.
We had first seen that in Scanners.
Are you from the outside?
Stop shaking.
I can't. Who are you?
Alex and me, we've got to move fast.
Move fast? You're goddamn right. I'll move fast.
Keep quiet.
Now, Snake Plissken, in this battle that he's just had to get the president, has been injured. He took an arrow in his leg, and he's pulled the arrow out, so he's limping. And this is what's going to really hurt him in terms of he does get captured.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously has to, you know, have this huge, you know, fight.
The president without a finger. A missing finger. Oh, and that's right, he has the
suitcase.
Suitcase.
Or briefcase.
Briefcase,
attached to his arm. And that briefcase is a tape of his speech, which he's going to be delivering in Boston on World Peace, which
yes.
is the reason why he was headed from Washington to Boston. And he ended up, what happened is, obviously, when they commandeered the jet, Air Force One, they flew over airspace, which was restricted, which was that over the prison.
Right.
And ultimately, these tapes get switched.
These valuable tapes.
I always wondered what that speech was going
right.
to be, that's going to save the world,
right.
that it was so important that it'd be, you know, handcuffed to his wrist.
These incredible words of...
Now, the gang back there is all extras from St. Louis. Pretty mm-hmm. good-looking
yeah.
faces.
Yeah.
Who are you?
We had a great time on this movie. I mean, it was really a fun movie to make.
Yeah, it really was. It was a learning experience. For me, it was the first union picture that I made. Yeah. It was the first IA movie.
And it was sort of an interesting thing for me because I had come off of Close Encounters and I was doing these sort of large movies. I was even trying to direct a few things, and then some things didn't happen. Oh, it was sort of a weird time. My father died, and my agent called me and said, you know, I think you should go back to work, and we've got this young group of people. They've done some great stuff, and I think it would be perfect for them. And that was Phil Gersh that put us together.
Right. And David Gersh, his son, was our agent.
Right.
And what's so interesting is for us, it was like having, a bona fide real production designer who is, you know, who's made huge Hollywood movies come and help us conceive this picture and conceive it in a budget that was just so below your normal standards.
Yeah. Well, you know.
And the tricks that we used
to
make it happen, you know, for that kind of budget.
Well, sometimes, you know, it helps having made big budget movies because you can see the areas that, you know, really achieve the effect you want and the areas that you waste.
Or that are excess.
That are excess.
I remember very early on one of the processes in the pre-production of the movie was when you had designed these various things, these effects. And we now ended up having to go and get bids on them. And it was amazing that the kinds of bids that we got for $3, $4, $5 million.
Yeah.
And then the fact that we were able to go to New World, to Roger Corman's place, where they had the same, you know, they had a motion control camera,
right,
and they could build miniatures, but they were building them with non-union. They were kids.
Yeah,
they're, you know,
young people.
Young kids. And the fact that we were able to get negotiate a deal with them for like, what, $360,000?
Yeah, that's about, there it goes, under $500,000.
Okay, here we are now on our Sepulveda Dam set.
Right.
In Los Angeles. And this is dawn. So he has 24 hours, and that's one of the ticking clock things.
Right.
And this is the great scene where we actually see the snake tattoo on him.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in the interior of the St. Louis train station.
Right. It's sort of the lobby area.
Target practice on the president.
Yeah, right.
And there's that very famous tattoo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, if it wasn't for the vehicles, like you mentioned, wardrobe, everything else, you know, this could be done today. You could just, you know, this is that sort of post-apocalyptic
kind of world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which they've done a lot since this time.
Diagram, Brian. Well, what's very funny is the movie takes place in 1997.
Right.
So it's interesting that in 1980, when we made the movie, we envisioned this to be 1997, and here we are in 2001.
I know.
Which I think is wild.
You know, we were talking, and I did a movie 10 years later called Free Jack, which I had to do a lot of similar stuff in New York, and no one ever came up with the idea of people walking around with cell phones. I mean, it's just unbelievable. You can't walk down the street now without seeing somebody with a cell phone.
We need him.
Get moving, Brain.
Oops. There goes the tape.
Mm-hmm.
Ha Now, of course, nowadays, the tape would be like a tiny little a computer chip.
A computer chip, of course.
Instead of, I'm surprised it's not an 8-track.
Yes. Yes. We were a little past 8-tracks at this time. Hard to project the future.
I know. It's kind of interesting to think, you know, you look back at sort of H.G. Wells and sort of futuristic things, and some of those things are true and some of them are not.
They still use Hueys a lot, though, you know. And airplanes, quite similar.
Here, this is a great scene.
Oh, yeah, this is a mat shot.
This is the mat shot. This is a scene in New York Central Park, and we shot it in a field, and we matted in New York in the background. Pretty good mat, I think. Did Al Whitlock do that mat, Bill Taylor?
Can't remember. We shot that somewhere around the Sepulveda
Basin.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. That's the Sepulveda Basin.
Right, and the other set's over here to the left.
It's very interesting to see a John Carpenter film in daylight.
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't seem as dark and imposing.
This is one of the few daylight scenes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, in Escape from L.A., one of the things that we did in comparison to Escape from New York, because, you know, again, it was he's injected with something, a poison, you know, a virus and all that kind of stuff. And it takes place over from dusk to dawn, as opposed to having a day scene.
I still can't figure out whether that son of a bitch Pliskin was...
Here again, we're at the USC Library, and it looks very, very different in the daylight.
Yeah.
I mean, the detail is phenomenal. God, I just can't imagine on our budget what we would have used had we not lucked into using the set.
No,
this practical location.
The night thing really works. It really works because I've been disappointed in movies that things were daytime, you know, effects. They just don't have the mystery about it.
Amnesty for all prisoners in New York City. And
say today they would computerize that stuff. You'd shoot it against a green screen and throw a computer imagery. But we did that with just big plastic.
We had no blue screen or green screen in this picture.
No. So much for your man. How
they hadn't yet used green, but...
didn't they use green screen for Superman?
I thought it was all blue.
I thought it was green because he wore blue.
And what year was that?
I don't know.
Because Chuck Kaminsky, who worked on this, used green for me on Jaws 3. Because
we were
underwater and we had blue suits. So you're probably right. It was very, very new, though.
Very, very, very new.
And that was in 82 or 3 that I did that.
We used a lot of green screen on Escape from L.A.
Yeah.
As opposed to... It's interesting to see the daylight.
Yeah. It does take a little mystery out of it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I love the, where we're coming up to the fight scene.
Right.
And I don't know, this was sort of a crazy idea of putting the chain link fence around the fighting ring. Gave it a little bit harsher environment.
I remember shooting this. This was really, oh, what a day. Because of the smoke in here. And, of course, we have the guy he fights. We brought him in from... he's a real wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
Here he is. Nice guy. Looks mean, though.
Yeah. looks pretty mean. Yeah, we really used that that location a lot, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. Look at that architecture.
Well, it does look just like Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
I keep calling it Madison Square Garden, but it's not. It's like a Madison Square Garden scene in Grand Central Station.
Right, exactly.
I shot the Grand Central Station for Fisher King. I shot a waltz where Robin Williams, you know, waltzes.
I remember that.
Now, of course, this is going to be a fight to the death.
Right.
But ultimately, it'll be a surprise.
Best man. And when we roll down the 69th Street Bridge tomorrow on our way to freedom, we're going to have their best man leading.
Now, what did you have to do to this building besides build the stands and the... And the ring.
Not a heck of a lot. You could see, I mean, it was just really falling apart.
Right.
And, So
you didn't even have to age it down or anything.
No, this was wonderful. This was a walk in and shoot. We did some of the little rooms. We just had to adjust some things, dress it, build this.
And so that's really cost effective because, once again, if you take a great place like a Grand Central Station now and you have to age it down, that's an enormous amount of labor.
Well, you have to age it, and then you have to restore it, and the restoration is incredible.
Right.
So,
so this was just a basically build the stage and build the ring and walk out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Take our lights and go. In fact, we probably improved the real estate because they could say, this is where Escape from New York was shot.
you know, here they had stuff, so we just had to rearrange the junk again, you know. And... but everything sort of, linked in. And then John Beaton, so accommodating, I mean, he found ways of shooting things.
What are you so nervous about?
You got to see the president.
Oh, yeah, this is like a little chapel back there.
No, it doesn't.
Well, I'll have to tell him you said that.
Wait a minute. Why?
Can't remember why that would be there.
What?
I'll show you.
You'll tell
me.
I think we did some special dressing in this room.
Gentlemen?
Oh, yes. This was old props.
President?
Yeah.
That we put in here.
Right.
Doesn't he look silly?
Yeah.
And did you see there was a computer? It looked like a computer screen there. Right there.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
But that was impossible. There were no computers.
What would it be? Well, they had computers that were just very slow, large. That doesn't look like a computer screen, though. Pan over a little bit, we'll see.
You know, there's a moment that we just saw right there where Snake Plissken has lost the ability to be able to communicate to Hawk. And he sees that the timekeeper has taken that, once again, that eagle that we all recognize.
Right.
And I think that's, part of the design of a film and part of, being a filmmaker, producer, director, production designer who talk about what a particular prop looks like so that as a plot point, it's instantly recognizable by the person watching the movie.
Well, this movie was fairly linear in the making of it. We didn't have an awful lot of interference.
That's right.
From executives and what have you. So if we had a thought that continued down the line, We didn't have somebody say, oh, wouldn't this be cool to do this? That had nothing to do with anything, which you have today quite often with a lot of executives or 19 producers and things like that, and people injecting ideas that don't follow through. This is, as you pointed out, a very, very simple visual item that is consistent.
Oh.
Yes. That's, we know what happened.
Wow, that's nasty.
Yet we didn't see an insert of it going through his head. Worked just fine.
Yeah, it worked fine. See, once again.
Yes.
The time clock. So we now know how long, and he's, you know, they know he's still alive. I mean, at this point in the movie, they've lost all track of him. They don't know if the president's alive. They don't know if he's alive. And they're just on this waiting game. And now they know. And he also, Snake Plissken, also knows how long he has, 1 hour, 34 minutes. And so what's interesting is now we begin the finale of the picture, which is this all-out chase to get to the wall. And also, too, what's great about this particular scene is that Snake Plissken comes in as a villain to these people because, you know, he's here to destroy their community.
Right.
And he ends up a hero.
Right.
And so now they're really going to go for him. But, of course, you know, the Duke of New York needs to keep, be empowered. So you have that dynamic set up between the two. But actually, this is a good day shot because it really gives the sense of scope to the set that we built. I mean, the idea of taking an existing structure like Sepulveda Dam, which we pass by a zillion times a day in the valley, and sticking these bunker tops on it really kind of gave us, for the budget, a really large scope. And, you know, once John shoots in that sort of anamorphic-sized lens...
Yeah.
And so we need to fill the screen.
Oh, look at this. This is CalArts.
CalArts.
In Valencia, and this is all the graffiti.
This is where he has to walk up to the glider that's on the top of the World Trade Center.
He has to climb, 200? with
it's a long walk.
With an arrow in his thigh. But that other shot, the daylight shot, was shot probably magic hour. You see the soft lighting?
Mm-hmm.
It really is... that was really quite pretty.
Make sure.
Well, because here we are at night.
Mm-hmm. There, yes.
This is where the glider gets thrown over the side of the. So here is right there.
Miniature.
Is a miniature.
Yeah.
Goddamn Redskins! They're savages, Mr. President.
Now, let me ask you something. Did you have some CalArts students work on this graffiti? I think you did.
Probably. Yes. I did have, a lot of kids because there was just one in various types of graffiti. But we had to come in and wallpaper all this.
Yeah, you put up the butcher paper. But think I even recall having CalArts kids be able to do whatever they wanted to.
Right.
Because it is an art school.
Right. What a mess we made.
I swear to God, Snake, I know where it is. Just take us to the car. I'll take you right to it.
I think, because we shot CalArts and Art Center, which are sort of competitors. Now we're back at Art Center. No, this is still CalArts. Different architecture.
Actually, you know what this is? This is a building on Wilshire, next to the Wiltern. That last scene where they come out.
The exterior is. The exterior, we were at Century City.
Well, no, the exterior, we're in Century City. Right. I remember having to go get that location. But this is, I think this is next to the Wiltern Theater. The last, well, maybe it's not, but it certainly reminds me of it.
Hi, Duke.
Oh, What a beautifully lit shot that is.
Snake, you and Brain just say goodbye to each other.
Now, we are going to be going to Century City in a second. This is Century City.
Yeah,
these are the twin towers in Century City. And we were told that we could put the debris on here. And we had to shoot it in such a way that this car doesn't get put out. It's actually the road.
Yeah.
In front of it.
We couldn't drive on it
for insurance purposes. And it was very funny. This is one time where being a woman producer really works, because Barry Bernardi called me and he said, you have to... Oh, and I'm just beginning to get a sense of where we shot the interiors. I know we shot on a soundstage, and I'll tell you why in just a second. Barry Bernardi came to me and he said, you have to, you know, come and meet with the building manager, because you have to explain to him exactly what we're going to do. So I can remember... being on the set, we were shooting the interior of the president's plane when Barry came to me and said, okay, it's time for us to go to Century City. I said, just a minute. And I went into the trailer and I changed. And I came out with a really short, sexy skirt and high heels and a blouse open to, you know, my cleavage. And I said, okay, I'm ready. And I went and sweet talked this manager into letting us get that exterior. And it worked.
And where were we?
That's in St. Louis.
No, but I mean the set.
We were at we were at Culver City Studios.
Oh, you're right. We were at Culver City Studios,
the old MGM.
Well, it was
Culver City Studios.
Well, wasn't it Oselznick's?
That's it.
Oselznick's studio.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep. Which Sony now owns.
Right.
Here we are on the bridge. Now, this is a bridge that goes between two states, and we basically started at one end and worked our way all the way across to where the wall would be. And this bridge is supposed to be the George Washington Bridge,
yes.
Upper level.
Right.
And
a little bit smaller. Oh, and yeah.
I like that.
So we got the great... chase with the chandeliers.
Do you remember what happened when we were on this bridge when the FBI came? What happened is this, is that Roy Arbogast was using a lot of liquid smoke.
Right.
And we had some liquid smoke shipped to us.
Oh,
look,
right.
There's the ball. I just saw the ball on the interior of the car, the dance ball.
Right.
We had some liquid smoke shipped to us from Los Angeles, and
the airplane thing.
Yes,
yeah, poor Roy. Oh my gosh!
And what happened is that
there's a half cab.
Half cab right there. You can see the split of the cab. And what happened to us was that when we shipped it onto the plane, they had forgotten to put flammable materials. Check that.
Right.
And on the plane landing, a passenger plane landing at the St. Louis airport, the bottle broke.
Oh,
and when the
right.
bottle is exposed to air, it makes liquid smoke. And the pilot thought the plane was on fire. And so they actually came out and they prepared the runway for an emergency landing.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And the plane landed. And then when they realized that it was a shipment for us, they actually went to our production office at the hotel to Chip Fowler, who was our production coordinator. And they questioned her. It was the FBI. And then the FBI came onto the bridge to get the liquid smoke. Do you remember this?
Yes.
Well,
I had a claim.
Well, there was a claim for years and years and years that we ended up having to settle for $10,000
with
the
that?
FAA. Absolutely. It was a fine.
Who paid it?
The production company. $10,000 fine. But anyway, here we are on the bridge. I mean,
this was an amazing
shooting. And we just worked our way night after night, bit by bit,
down this bridge. Moving cars, struggling who gets the forklift to move this stuff. Larry Franco is very animated, very, very good for assistant producer now.
And he just produced Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah, right.
So what's interesting about this particular scene, soon Maggie will die. And when we shot this, we did not really have a close-up of her dying.
Hmm.
And when we previewed the movie, the audience wanted to know what happened to Maggie. So we ended up doing a reshoot of Maggie dying in John and Adrienne's driveway.
Yeah, well, those things those things work.
She's a great character here. She's a defiant character who wouldn't leave, you know, Brain, and who basically made it work for Snake Plissken to get away. I mean, Maggie is the hero here. She's the one who stands up to the Duke, and she takes the Duke out.
But she gets squashed.
Right.
See, so we never had any close-up after...
You'll see.
Yeah.
You'll see. Watch. There's...
Oh.
That's the insert.
Yeah, well, that looks like a John Carpenter insert.
That's the insert that we shot in John's driveway.
Things happen like that, you know, in movies. Big movies, we shot in some inserts in my driveway on Jaws. It's just you need the thing.
Well, a lot of time, too, is that you have the production values of the big wide shots,
and
you have to shoot them. And then you a list of the close-ups, you know, you save for another time, an insert stage or something like that.
Right.
Once again, there's the eagle. Totally transforms, you know, a Jeep and lets us know where we are. And this is preparing Snake Plissken to go over the wall. This is on the St. Louis side of the bridge.
Now, this wall.
And we built this giant wall.
Yeah, we had to build this wall. And this first time... I sort of worked this way. We got contracted a scaffold company to come out and put 50 feet high, 200 feet of scaffold. And they did that in a very economical manner. And then we had a crew, you know, tying plywood to it and then painting it. Our brilliant scenic people, Ward Welton, who was great, textured it. And we did it for an incredible... low cost, because that was a huge build in our script. How are we going to do this wall?
But what's so interesting is the design of the printing that you have on the side that says station number, whatever, as well as the railing ties this into the Sepulveda Dam, which is where we are when we open the picture, and it just kind of gives the whole thing. You know, you get the sense that there is this wall around Manhattan, and this is the Washington Bridge, and so it's about geography.
Yeah. Yeah, because we did establish the wall early on. And we did it sort of rough, so you can get away with a lot of stuff.
Right.
You know? Because you have scale there, you know? It's
Okay, now, this is great. This is the double cross. This is the presidential double cross here. And he kills. There he goes.
Yeah. The
president. What
kills.
A great president, huh?
The Duke.
It's wonderful president. Well, the president in Escape from L.A. is just the worst. I mean, he is really so right-wing and conservative that Donald Pleasance looks like
him.
Yeah.
Sweet guy. This is the other side of the wall.
They only have a few seconds to get this.
Tick, tick, tick. Don't you remember the T-shirts?
This explosive.
Do you have any of those left?
Yes, I do.
With the countdown on it, Escape from New York. I think mine finally wore out. Too bad. I like to save those.
That's it.
Two seconds. Wow.
Yeah. Made it. Just in time.
Just in time. I love this end scene, this coda here that we have, you know, with the with Snake Plissken. It's what makes him such this incredible, lovable anti-hero. And I think it's one of the reasons why Snake Plissken, you know, has been kept alive for 20 years, mm-hmm. and why, you know, we were able to do a sequel after 17 years, and why we're in the process of putting a game together and a television series and everything. So, and the fact that Kurt Russell loved to play this character so much. I mean, I really do believe that there's a side to John Carpenter and Kurt Russell that is Snake Plissken, the defiant, you know, against authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what really makes the picture work, you know, is that we all want to be the guy that defies it. It's kind of a universal thing.
Yeah.
I want to thank them. This nation appreciates their sacrifice. Look, I'm on the air in 2.5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Boy, your set looks wonderful there.
Yeah, that worked. And well, you know, it's a combination of shapes and lighting.
And I think it's the way it's being shot now. You know, in the
beginning, there's the silver.
I think in the beginning. Oh yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
I think in the beginning, you know, you're fast, you're moving, you're telling plot, and here we have the ability now to settle, move slower, and you get to get a sense of the scope and size and the detail of the set.
I want you to think it over while you're resting. I want to give you a job. We'd make one hell of a
the
team.
The flag hanging like that had reminded me of the Germany, World War II, and the swastikas hanging down. It was very militant looking, you know, as opposed to our flag really flying loose and free. This was
definitely a
very
statement.
Symbolic, you know.
Symbolic statement of the kind of totalitarian government that we have in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Good evening. Although I shall not be present at this historic summit meeting, I present this in the hope that our great nations may learn to live in peace.
When's the music come on? Right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is, he's going to play the speech.
Right.
The most important speech of world peace.
Right.
And we get the American Bandstand. Good old Dick Clark.
Right, right.
I just love this double cross.
Double cross. Boy, those shapes really work. I don't know if this location's been used again or since or before. Well, I mean, I'm, you know.
It's so, I think we used it so well, I don't think anybody else would want to use it. Well, I guess that's it. We're at the end of Escape from New York. Joe Alves, I want to thank you for sharing all your memories with me and with our audience. And
it was a lot of fun, Deborah.
A lot of fun, too.
Good seeing you again.
Nice to see you. Thanks for coming.